members were here, but we do have a quorum. And with that, I'm going to start talking about all of the bills that are related to SAFE, the State Industrial Accident Insurance Fund. I'm not going to do things necessarily in any order. I'm sorry about that. But I am going to... my objective is that ultimately I'm going to use one of these bills as a vehicle and tie in various pieces of other bills into something that will change how SAFE is operating, make it truly, I think, more transparent, which has been some of Brenda Rockland's goals and so on. But to get us started, I wanted Senator Walker to take a few minutes and talk about her bill. She's put a lot of work into SAFE. Some of what is in her bill may end up in 310 if that's the vehicle I decide to use. Others have been kind of thinking about amendments out of some of the other bills. And there's some specific questions that I'll be asking people as well. I'm going to ask Judith if she'll start by just giving us a little catch line on Senator Walker's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 752 requires the Board of Directors of SAFE Corporation to submit their annual budget and a report of their operations to the Governor, the President of the Senate, Speaker of the House, and Legislative Fiscal Officer. It instructs the Fiscal Officer to submit a statement of findings and conclusions after review of the corporation's submissions, and as well as the Secretary of State audit of the corporation to the Joint Legislative Committee on Ways and Means. It requires the manager of the corporation to pay expenses incurred in the preparation of that review. It would declare an emergency effective on passage. We have received a no revenue impact. We have not received any word from fiscal on the bill yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And with that, I'm going to just say right up front, I'm not asking Senator Walker to go down front because I want her to stay up here. You can see her and hear her just as well sitting here as down at the dais. Senator Walker, would you like to hold forth for a few minutes? And then I'm going to give some people that have signed up a chance to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Judith, I think I got it. All right. This bill, Mr. Chair, I started out with big intentions, and now I'm down to just little bitty ones. So let me explain the process. I wanted to bring SAFE back in as a state agency. That was my number one goal. And when I started talking with my colleagues in the building, I got the sense that no one wanted to really do that. There wasn't a big stampede to assist me in that effort. I also had a discussion with Legislative Council, and that would have been an overwhelming task, which they were going to do, but it wasn't something I was going to put them through if we didn't have the support for it. So I went back and I said, well, let's not do that. Let's just bring SAFE in under budget so that the legislature approves their budget. Well, that was Plan B. That didn't work either, because when we had a discussion with the fiscal office, we determined that SAFE cannot be under a legislatively approved budget unless they are a state agency. So they're either in or they're out in order for us to have any control over their budget. So now we're at Plan C, Mr. Chair, and that is Senate Bill 752. And I modeled Senate Bill 752 after a statute that I just passed out to you, ORS 461.140, and that might be familiar to Ms. Rockland. That statute says that the Oregon State Lottery Commission shall prepare in each even-numbered year a budget report for the biennium beginning July 1 of the following year. And that requires them to bring their budget before the legislature for review. The legislature cannot pass on their budget. They just simply review it and ask questions, because the lottery is basically a fourth branch of government. They were created by the Constitution, and they can do their own thing, which they seem to do for a while until Ms. Rockland went in there and cleaned that agency up. So, Senate Bill 752 requires Safe Corporation to bring their budget, to submit it to the legislature not later than April 15th of each year. In odd-numbered years, the report will be submitted to the governor, the president of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, and the Joint Ways and Means Committee, as well as the legislative fiscal officer. And in the even-numbered years, it will go to the emergency board and the other folks. The budget must be prepared in a manner that the legislative fiscal officer asks it to be prepared in, because we are familiar with looking at budgets here in a specific way. That information must be submitted, and it will be reviewed and presented to those parties. The little kicker on it that Safe Corporation probably does not like is that Safe Corporation would have to reimburse the Legislative Fiscal Office for all expenses incurred in the preparation and review of that budget.
Excuse me for being a wise guy, but it wouldn't be any more expensive than a lobbyist, probably. Never mind. I shouldn't have said that.
That was
a low blow.
No, that was actually quite good, Mr. Chair. And I would agree with you, especially one that was paid $40,000 a month. Anyway, the whole idea for bringing this budget to our review is so that we have a chance to see how this state agency is spending its money, what it's spending its money on, what it's doing for the state. I don't want just this little booklet that I get every year about the glories of Safe Corporation. I want to get down and dirty. I want to look at what's going on. And I think that's paramount for us to do as keepers of the State Accident Insurance Fund. It's an agency that's on its own, but we really have some authority and control in that we created it, and we need to mind the store. This was the best thing I could do outside of getting it back in as a state agency. We didn't get rid of Safe Corporation with ballot measure 38. The state of Oregon spoke about that. So the best we can do is to look out for the money, to look out for the injured workers, and to keep some oversight on what they are doing over there. And that's why I brought Senate Bill 752 forward, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Walker. I'm going to ask Brenda Rockland if she'd come forward, and I guess Chris Davies wants to come along. By the way, I want you all to know that some friends of mine are in the room today. They happen to be members of the United Methodist Church, and they have been here just kind of as a presence, human services advocates that they are, and I just want to welcome them to the committee this afternoon. They're listening in for as long as they have time. I know they have to get back to Portland, but I want to welcome each of these fine ladies. When I grew up in western Pennsylvania, there was a United Methodist women back there, but I always thought the UMW was the United Mine Workers when I was growing up, and lo and behold, I get out here and find that they're really a very, very fine group of people. Not to say that the United Mine Workers weren't, but it's kind of fun how we play with acronyms through time. Brenda, simple question. Why shouldn't SAFE kind of budget like the lottery? Why shouldn't its budget be treated the same as the lottery's budget is now?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brenda Rockland, the interim president and CEO of Safe Corporation, with me today is Chris Davey, who is the government affairs director for the Safe Corporation. In answer to your question, I think that's what we have tried to do in Senate Bill 310. What we set forth in that particular bill is that on April 15th, at the same time we prepare our traditional annual report, we would then set forth our operating budget as well in that particular report and submit it to the legislature and the governor at that time. And then, as you know from Senate Bill 310, we're also proposing that the president of Safe Corporation, at the request of Ways and Means or the Emergency Board, would appear on an annual basis and discuss Safe Corporation's budget and answer any questions that the legislature may have on that budget. And so that's, I think, the bottom line in terms of our opposition to Senate Bill 752. For the most part, we just believe Senate Bill 310 actually covers most of this.
I want to be a little more specific. What's the difference between how you would bring it as you see it, or maybe I should ask Senator Walker first and then have you respond. Senator Walker, what differences do you see as differences, similarities between how they suggest doing it in Senate Bill 310 and your bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, my bill requires SAFE to submit its budget according to the needs of the Legislative Fiscal Office so that they can review it, so they can see between the lines and understand where the money is being spent and where the money is going and coming. The way SAFE prepares its budget may not be in compliance with how they regularly review budgets down in LFO. And I see this as an objection that Ms. Rockland has in her written testimony.
In other words, and I will give you a chance to return any of your written testimony. Welcome, Senator Starr. The question I've just asked, Senator, is what is the difference between Senate Bill 310 and how Ms. Rockland proposes to submit their budget under Senate Bill 310, their SAFE budget, and how it would be done under Senator Walker's bill? And Senator Walker has just pointed out that the one difference would be that the Legislative Fiscal Office has its style, and she's asking for more compatibility with that. Brenda, how would you like to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think I'm obviously familiar with ORS 461-140, which does require the lottery budget to be submitted. I guess what I would say to that is that Senator Walker is absolutely correct. That is a difference between 310 and her bill in that this would actually be submitted to LFO as well, and they would I guess discuss with us what the most appropriate form would be to submit the budget. I will speak though to practical experience based on work at the Oregon Lottery that we did have a different process in submitting our budget to LFO and the legislature at the Oregon Lottery that did not appear to present any practical problem with LFO having an opportunity to review the budget, understand what was going on, and then participate in the budget discussion we had with the legislature for the Oregon Lottery. And I would anticipate that the same thing would occur under Senate Bill 310. If LFO obviously had questions about budget detail, we would provide the information LFO needed to inform the Oregon legislature.
Maybe I'm asking an unfair question. You're flying at too high of an altitude, maybe as a director, to see it at this detail level, but have you asked LFO what the difference would be in terms of your workload if you had to prepare it according to Senator Walker's suggestion as versus according to what you're suggesting in 310?
Well, Mr. Chair, I may let Mr. Davey actually answer that question because I think he had the direct contact with LFO because
okay.
we did try to follow up on that yesterday in preparation for today's hearing. But I would tell you that it just in the past, based on my experience, LFO has not had any issue understanding the Oregon Lottery budget. And I don't think, having gone through the SAFE budget for hundreds of hours this last fall, I can tell you that there's enough budget detail there that I don't have any doubt that LFO would know where the money's going and why.
So maybe we should ask LFO to come in and tell us what their if they are satisfied with it the way it is, or whether they see some merit in what Senator Walker is suggesting. Mr. Davies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Chris Davey from SAFE Corporation. I did have a conversation with Ken Rocco, Legislative Fiscal Officer, when I saw this bill, and asked him how he saw that it would be implemented. He really hadn't had a chance to review it yet, and he didn't have any clear procedure in mind about how that budget would be prepared. The issue that we've raised in this written testimony is that currently SAFE's budget has to be prepared in accordance with something that's called statutory accounting principles. And that's a national standard by which insurance companies do their accounting, and consequently their budget is structured in a way that supports that those principles. I would imagine that the Legislative Fiscal Office would be sensitive to that, and that there would be a way to work those things out. With all due respect, Senator Walker, we did say that we oppose Senate Bill 752, but we don't oppose the concept, because that is in fact the same concept that we put into Senate Bill 310. There are some details of Senate Bill 752 that we don't really clearly understand the purpose for those steps, and there are some things that need to be clarified. And if you would like, Mr. Chair, I can just go through those points quickly now.
Feel free, whichever one of you wants to go through this testimony, to go ahead and go for a few minutes.
Under Senate Bill 752, we would be required to provide a budget report and a performance report every year by April 15th of the year. I think there's a drafting error in the bill, because it says that we would have to provide the performance report for the current year. And in fact, that year would only be 3 months old, so we could hardly be summarizing that year's performance. It probably should say the prior year, but it would involve the current year's budget. Now, under the law that exists today, there are several requirements already in place for us to provide reports to the legislature and the governor. ORS 656751 sub 8 says that we have to provide a report on our operations for the previous year to the governor and the Legislative Assembly. And 656774 says that by March 15th of each year, we must give a financial report for the previous year to the Secretary of State. So the report that's called for in addition to the budget in Senate Bill 752 may well be duplicating what we're already doing under those other statutes.
Yes,
go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Davey, I would like you to describe for me what an operational report is and what a financial report is, please.
Yes, Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I don't think those sections of statute are in the bill here, but the operational report very simply says that SAFE must provide a report on its operations to the legislature. And, Senator, I believe you alluded to getting an annual report. We do an annual report every year that's kind of like a corporate annual report. It's mainly our financial statements, and we provide those to every legislator. It's by statute, it's a report of operations, and it includes some discussion about what we've done. So that's the operational report. The financial report is some fairly specific requirements about loss reserves, assets, investment return, and so on. That was passed by the legislature just a couple of sessions ago, and that report has to be given to the Secretary of State by March 15th, and then that triggers an audit that the Secretary of State performs in conjunction with a private actuarial consultant, and then that becomes the SAFE annual audit by the Secretary of State. So probably what we're already providing would be covering the same material as might be in a report on performance, but perhaps performance could be defined a little more clearly so that we would know how that might differ. Other issues in Senate Bill 752, the Legislative Fiscal Officer would review the budget and then prepare findings and conclusions. Not only would he review the budget, but also the performance report, the most recent report from the Secretary of State, any response from SAFE to the audit, and the financial report that comes from Senate from 656774.
As soon as you're done, Senator Verger has a question. I was just looking for a good place to interrupt you there, sir.
Any place is good.
Would you like to continue before I ask my question?
No, please go ahead.
That would be fine. I want at some point, right now you're comparing 310 and 752, and I appreciate that. What I don't have is the knowledge of what you did before these two bills came. So in order for me to get it into context when we finish the comparison, if you will tell me what you did before, I would appreciate
okay.
it.
Okay, yes, be happy to do that, Senator. So just to continue with the testimony, the question is what would be the findings and conclusions that the Legislative Fiscal Officer would provide, and what would be the standards by which he would review the budget and produce findings and conclusions, and I think that would need to be spelled out. And then the other point that was raised was simply the one of reimbursing the Legislative Fiscal Office for its work, and we did check with them to see whether that's usual or if it ever happens at all. They told us that none of their work is, are they paid by the person whose budget or whatever is being reviewed, and they're not reimbursed for their services right now. So I think in summary,
I'm going to let Senator Walker ask her question.
Yeah, the reason, Mr. Chair, I would submit it that that's true is there are only two agencies in this whole darn state that operate like SAFE. It's SAFE and OHSU. So I would say that's why no other agency has this requirement.
Well, Senator Walker, I guess the lottery also prepares its budget and sends it to the legislative fiscal office, but apparently they do not bill anybody for their services at the moment.
Okay. But the lottery is kind of a standalone. We don't have any jurisdiction over the lottery. We have jurisdiction over you, however.
Yes. So, in essence, I think that Senate Bill 752 could probably be synthesized with what we have in Senate Bill 310, but there are some issues and questions and wording that would need to be worked out.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The other issue I have with Senate Bill 310 is on line 41. It says, if requested to do so, the manager shall appear to present information about the budget. This doesn't say anything about requiring the Ways and Means Committee to review the budget. It just says if requested to do so. I really want the legislature to take a more proactive role.
Okay.
And we also, in 310, it doesn't say when this information would be made available at all. It doesn't address that.
You want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I think under Senate Bill 310, we would provide that information on or before April 15th in connection with our annual report.
Is that in the written form in the bill?
No. Section 5, page 3.
On page 2 of the printed bill, section 3, subsection 8, we were proposing to amend the statute that talks about the annual report being submitted before April 15th of each year, and then broadening that to include not just our activities and operations, but also then the annual budget of SAFE Corporation.
Okay, and so, Mr. Chair, that appears that not later than April 15th of each year, so that's not a biennial review, that's every single year.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that would be correct because we do prepare an annual budget at SAFE Corporation, so our expectation in the bill is that we would submit that each year to the Oregon Legislature and then appear either before Ways and Means or the Emergency Board.
Okay.
If I could respond to Senator Verger's question, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, the report that we provide right now is something that goes to the governor and I believe to all members of the Legislative Assembly, and it just takes the form of an annual report of the corporation. It has abbreviated financial statements and explanations of the financial statements and then some just general discussion of the activities and the operations of SAFE Corporation. And then in addition to that, we have a much more detailed financial reporting requirement. And right now that goes to the Secretary of State, and then that triggers or precedes an audit that the Secretary of State performs every year. And, Senator, if you'd like copies of those reports, I'd be happy to give them to you.
Thank you very much. I was just trying to get in my own mind the process and how this would be different than the process that you've been through.
Any further questions? Are you finished? All right. What I'd like to do is have us step back for a minute. I've got, in my mind, and I think it's kind of an interesting analogy. I've been around these United Methodist women. One of the things I've been doing for 30 years is watching at times when they'd get together and make a quilt. Well, in a real sense, I see the potential for what we're doing is taking pieces of all five of these bills and in various places kind of quilting them together. I know that's a strange image for maybe some people to think about, but I think some of what Senator Walker's raising needs to be addressed. I think we may have to find some ways to massage some of this to make it a little stronger than it is in Senate Bill 310. Having said that, it would be my intention to listen to Senate Bill 507 in the same light. Let's be honest. 507 has already been presented in John DiLorenzo's testimony as he responded to 310. And so I don't want a full-blown half an hour of testimony on the bill. But what I do want is for Devin in here, to come forward and make a quick testimony about it, recognizing that Mr. DiLorenzo was here already. And then I'm going to invite Brenda and Chris to come back and comment on that piece. And I'm going to keep doing that throughout the afternoon. The list is going to get longer because there's more and more people wanting to testify on each bill as I go down through the day. Okay? So I'm going to open a public hearing on 507, recognizing that you're commenting, I suppose, on 310 and may have some other comments at the same time. But, Judith, I'm going to ask you just real quick to comment on 507. And then we'll let Devin hold forth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Members. Senate Bill 507 establishes a right to inspect certain records of the State Accident Insurance Fund Corporation. It does create exceptions. It allows the corporation to charge fees for the cost of making those records available, and it provides for the determination of the rights of a person aggrieved by the failure of the corporation to make those same records available. We have received a no revenue impact statement on the measure, no from fiscal yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, Devin, depending on how familiar everybody is with what you're going to be saying, you can kind of choose your own speed, okay?
Okay. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Devin Lyon. I am an associate with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine. I'm here on behalf of Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy in support of Senate Bill 507. As you know, members of my firm have litigated a number of cases relating to Safe Corporation. In particular, in his capacity representing OSAP, John DiLorenzo spearheaded an effort to gain access to certain documents of Safe Corporation to provide the public with insight as to how this public agency works. And in light of what you asked me to do, these are abbreviated comments because I realized in Senate Bill 310 earlier in January that Mr. DiLorenzo did, in fact, address a lot of these issues. But I still believe it's important to provide a little bit of context and provide a brief history, and it's much more brief than you've been provided in the past. OSEP's original request for safe documents began in January of 2000. In April of that year, based on public records law, SAFE demanded a $65,000 advance fee in order to process the request and made it clear that it would withhold many of the documents which OSEP was requesting based on trade secrets. In July of 2000, OSEP filed suit in Marion County Circuit Court to require the production of the documents. In March of 2001, Judge Lipscomb ruled in OSEP's favor and declared that SAFE could not rely on trade secrets or other public records exceptions to shield its documents from review. That was based on the court's view that public records law was not the sole vehicle for gaining inspection of records, and that Chapter 656 contained its own particular inspection provision, giving the public the right to inspect the records of SAFE, the Accident Insurance Fund. In April of 2001, SAFE appealed Judge Lipscomb's decision. In June of that year, Judge Lipscomb ordered SAFE to conduct a full and faithful review of its records, to produce those records for which no exemption applied, and to keep track of those and withhold them in a separate log pending review. In May of 2003, the Oregon Court of Appeals affirmed Judge Lipscomb's decision. SAFE thereupon petitioned the Oregon Supreme Court. In October of 2003, the Oregon Supreme Court denied SAFE's petition for review, and on October 7th of 2003, OSEP demanded production of all documents withheld by SAFE. They did, in fact, provide many of the documents requested. But in May and early June of 2004, a former high-ranking official at Safe Corporation came forward and alleged that he had been ordered to destroy and reclassify documents in order to keep them from public view. That disclosure gave rise to the contempt proceeding, which Mr. DiLorenzo litigated between June and August of last year, and which culminated in the circuit court holding Safe Corporation in contempt and assessing the largest fine ever assessed against a state agency. OSEP supports Senate Bill 507, because the bill addresses both a necessary and important public policy of continuing to allow citizens the right to inspect the records of Safe Corporation while addressing Safe's safety and security concerns. Specifically, Senate Bill 507 protects certain sensitive information that Safe Corporation is permitted by the courts to protect. Examples from the bill include employer account records, claimant files, information that would reveal the security measures taken or recommended to be taken to protect officers or employees, buildings or other property, etc. While protecting both Oregon citizens' rights to inspect documents and Safe Corporation's sensitive information, Senate Bill 507 still allows for bona fide rating organizations to inspect certain records, and I'll skip some of the specifics on that based on your request. Safe Corporation may still establish fees reasonably calculated to recover the costs of making the records available, and it does provide for a person that believes they are aggrieved by the failure of the corporation to make the records available. It gives them a process already established in statute. As I touched on earlier, and Mr. DiLorenzo went over in greater detail on January 20th, 2005, before this committee in opposition to Senate Bill 310, it is OSEP's position and the holding of Oregon courts that under the particular public inspection provisions in Chapter 656, Safe Corporation cannot rely on trade secrets or other public record exemptions to shield its documents from review. Senate Bill 507 retains the important spirit of Chapter 656 by replacing that original language with language designed to both protect the public's right to inspect Safe Corporation's documents and the corporation's legitimate concern over sensitive information. In fact, the new protective add-backs were part of a compromise proposal made by OSEP during the 2003 legislative session. Safe rejected that compromise, we believe hoping that they would prevail in the Supreme Court. The corporation did not prevail. Regardless, OSEP is willing to propose the former compromise again because we believe it is good public policy. It is OSEP's position that Safe Corporation should not be connected solely to the public records law contained in ORS 192, and that Senate Bill 507 addresses Safe Corporation's expressed concerns over certain types of information. It is our position that Senate Bill 507 solves the public record concern expressed by both sides over the last few years. Furthermore, it protects the public from returning to the days when Safe Corporation could assert trade secrets and other exemptions contained in the public records law to shield selected documents from public view. In the past, Safe has asked why it should be treated differently from other agencies that have the right to protect trade secrets. In the first place, Chapter 192 is a baseline for the minimum level disclosure expected by state agencies. The court recognized that the legislature can always expect an enhanced level of transparency from some state agencies. Second, a higher level of transparency is required of SAFE given the way SAFE operates. Most agencies utilize trade secrets exceptions within the public records law to protect private information submitted by private parties who the agencies regulate. Few agencies have trade secrets of their own. Unlike most agencies, SAFE has a history of abuse of the trade secrets exception for the purpose of hiding its own documents. This makes SAFE fairly unique. In addition, unlike most agencies, the legislature, as we just talked about, has no budget control over SAFE. And given the absence of those budgetary controls, this type of transparency is essential. Finally, we believe that revising Chapter 656 in Senate Bill 507, it implements the spirit of the Senate Interim Committee on General Government's Statement of Workers' Compensation Principles regarding increased transparency of the state workers' compensation program. That's a mouthful. We look forward to continuing to work with the committee on a number of bills. As you've stated, this may in fact become a type of quilt, and we want to be fully engaged in the process of patching it together. I would be happy to answer questions from the members of the committee.
Thank you. Maybe my image of a quilt isn't a good one, but since we're talking to insurance companies, I think they are into blanket coverage, you know. And so maybe it's not too bad of an image, come to think of it. Are there questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, the only question is really a comment. I agree with Mr. Lyon, given all of the history we've had over the last 2 years. Has it been that long? I don't know. It was December that I filed my complaint with the ethics
committee. It's been a number of years, yes.
It's been a long time for me, and it's been a lot longer for your firm.
Thank you, ladies.
I think it's appropriate, and I appreciate his comment.
Since we don't have questions, we'll let you step back.
Okay.
And here we go again. Brenda's probably getting tired of walking up here, but it's your turn.
Pete Shepard is coming.
Pete, welcome. Maybe what you'll consider an off-the-wall question, you know, from the chair again or something. But, you know, if you tried to boil down the arguments you just heard to one sentence, and that's kind of what I try to do from time to time, why not either have legislative budget control or the kind of transparency that's talked about in 507? How would you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brenda Rocklin, interim president and CEO of Safe Corporation. Mr. Chair, I would respond to that by saying that I believe, properly applied, Senate Bill 310 ensures transparency, but at the same time treats Safe Corporation like all other public agencies in the area of public records. And I think in terms of good public policy, that's exactly where we should be. And I know prior meetings with this committee, I have talked about public policy. OSEP has now talked about public policy. And I thought it might be appropriate today to have the committee hear from Deputy Attorney General Pete Shepard to share his thoughts on what good public policy is in the area of public records. So he may have a fuller answer to that question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. When Ms. Rocklin contacted me and asked me to participate and help the committee, I tried to think of what I could bring to the committee that might be different than what you're going to hear from other folks. And I think that probably institutionally has to do with the Attorney General's role in the administration of the public records law. And so I'll try to give you a sense of that perspective as you're weighing out the different policy choices mm-hmm. that you have to make. First, the public records law begins with a presumption that all records are disclosable unless they're within one of the exemptions. The basic presumption of the public records law is a transparency presumption. The basic idea of the law then precedes these exemptions that you've heard discussed are exceptions to the general rule of transparency that's provided in the public records law. And many of those exemptions, the burden rests upon the agency to establish different factual premises that are the justification for withholding. But one important conceptual piece that's important to think through as you're thinking about public records law is that the existence of the basis for an exemption is, in general, and in most instances, not a requirement that the agency assert that exemption. That is to say, with very few exceptions, the exemptions from the general rule of transparency in public law are not exceptions that require the agency to maintain the confidentiality of a given document, but rather that permit it if the agency makes a policy choice to do that. So I think as your committee members are thinking through the policy consequences of putting SAFE fully under the public records mandate, thinking through that overall umbrella structure of the public records law and the fact that it may give authority to withhold records, but that authority is nonetheless not, the agency is not compelled to withhold records that are within an exemption. Let me just give you another perspective, too, on differences between proceeding under the public records law and some sort of either mixture of public records law or entirely under a specialized statute as we currently have in the existing status quo. This is the Attorney General's Public Records and Meetings Manual. This is my own well-thumbed copy of that. About 180-some-odd pages of that are devoted to the public records law. It represents an accumulation of 30 years or more of litigation. I think I just perused the index. There are about 60 decided cases that we cite in the public records manual on the subject of what the public records law means and how that presumption of transparency is to be carried out. And then we have, in addition to that, the Attorney General's Office issues public records orders when agencies deny a person access to records, and those records, too, are published and become part of a network that helps requesters and agencies alike triangulate on the right answer to a given public records question. This, in contrast, are these are the 11 pages of the Court of Appeals opinion that was referred to in the earlier testimony, that constitute essentially the only appellate guidance that we have about the meaning of the statutes that currently govern, and according to the Court of Appeals, essentially exclusively govern the disclosure of records that SAFE has in its material. The difference between these two models is very dramatic, both for agencies in terms of the efficiency of responding to public records requests, and in terms of, perhaps more importantly, citizens' expectations about access to those records. The body of law that's accumulated around the state public records law allows many folks to resolve, many agencies and requesters to resolve questions about the disclosability of a record without the necessity of engaging any lawyers in any part of it. And indeed, I would wager to say that that the great majority of public records requests that do come to agencies today governed by the public records law are resolved in exactly that fashion between the requester and the agency. In addition to that, even when the case has reached the point of an individual who seeks to challenge the denial of a public records request, that petition again goes to, under the public records law in general, goes to the Attorney General's office. And even there, many of those disputes are never litigated because sometimes the consultation that generates between the Attorney General's office and the agency in question results in the disclosure of all or most of the records that have been requested but previously denied by the agency. And even when we do find that there is litigation about public records issues that come up under the public records law, we find that those cases are relatively easier to resolve because we have this history and accumulation of previously decided law on the question. So even in the litigated cases, that litigation is likely to be dramatically more efficient than other cases. Those considerations then are not, I'm sure, a complete answer to all the policy questions that you have to evaluate as a committee as you stitch together your quilt here. But they are, I think, the piece that I can perhaps bring to bear, perhaps uniquely, to the discussion.
When you laid the Attorney General's book on the dais there, looking at that, it looked like quite a journal. And then you laid the appellate court decision beside it, and I don't know if the purpose was to do what it did to me, but it looks kind of puny by comparison. Okay? Given what you did, would you say the appellate court didn't want to look at that big book you have on your right there? And they threw it out. They wanted to disregard it. It didn't measure up, and therefore you got, what did you say, an 11-page opinion? Why did they get where they got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think it was out of I don't think any of those considerations explain the court's opinion. What the court did rather was apply the currently prevailing, very precise, almost arithmetic of analyzing the meaning of statutes. And the court worked its way through the set of statutes that apply under current law to the governance of SAFE's records, and in parallel looked at the public records statutes and considered the argument of the Department of Justice that the public records exemptions applied as well as the procedures and the standards that apply specifically to SAFE. And what the court decided in its analysis of that statute was that it rejected the argument of the Attorney General that the public records exemptions applied, and rather found that those exemptions did not provide a basis for SAFE to withhold records that otherwise would be disclosable under SAFE's statutory scheme. The court's opinion was the result then, I think, Mr. Chair, of a careful analysis of the text of those statutes rather than any kind of policy judgment about which of the two potential options that you face now as legislators was a preferred or less desirable or more desirable option.
If Senate Bill 10, at least its disclosure portions, didn't move forward at all, if 507 didn't move forward at all, where would SAFE be?
I think, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think SAFE would be in a position in which it would face a future of uncertainty about in terms of the public records question. Now, Ms. Rockland is better equipped to address the business consequences of that potentially. But in terms of,
I'm just talking about the records transparency part.
In terms of both SAFE and I would say also requestors, would face a future that would be characterized, I think, fairly by a lot of uncertainty about where the boundaries of SAFE's of the disclosure requirements that exist then under the current law. And I think we can see that even as this case has played out, because we're not done with the litigation on this case. And indeed, one of the remaining pieces that we're trying to work through now, I should say collaboratively with Mr. DiLorenzo, but nonetheless one that we're trying to work through now, is just the very question of are there particular records that we believe that there are still some particular individualized documents that we think are within what the category of records that SAFE is indeed required to withhold. And Mr. DiLorenzo has a good faith opinion that that's not the case. Now, I would submit to you that's the very kind of dispute that, if we were operating under the public records manual, would likely be relatively easier to resolve. We have, in the form of the court's opinion in this case, just a single point on a field, if you will. And if you think about that, a single point on a field is not a very good predictor of where the boundaries of the permissible disclosure or the required disclosure might be. Whereas under the public records manual, we've got this whole accretion of 30 years of litigation. That defines parameters for requesters and agencies alike to use to come to their relatively efficient answers about what is disclosable and what is not.
Maybe I'm missing something here, but admit you can explain it to me. I'm certainly not a lawyer, and it takes a while to get through to me anyway. But wouldn't it be correct that, given that the appeals court rendered a decision, DiLorenzo was able to get his hands on lots of records, moving into the future, wouldn't that little puny piece of paper there kind of be the law that governs SAFE rather than that much more substantial document? And why would DiLorenzo and company be motivated to see anything change?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not going to presume to speak for Mr. DiLorenzo's motivations, but I would say that part of what you have said is, I think, exactly correct. That is, the court's opinion defines this dispute definitively. Although, as I say, we're still trying to figure out in its application to some particular pieces of paper in the trial court exactly how the court's opinion affects that. But for this dispute, this is a definitive answer. But the next dispute, and the one after that, and the one after that, those are going to continue to be uncertainties for both the people who submit those requests and for SAFE or any other agency that operates under a unique or specialized set of public records laws that are not, as to which we don't have the benefit of this 30 years of experience. So I think the reason that I would suggest that a hypothetical future requester might have an interest in having some change be made in the applicable law is that the requesters, too, will face uncertainty unless changes are made about what it is that's disclosable and what is not.
Questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shepherd, I'm not following your logic, because the appellate court decision now can just go into that little red book there and become part of the 30 years of case law that add to the public records law. I'm not sure why you think it's so obtrusive.
Mr. Chair, ma'am, Senator Walker, the court's opinion in this case does not add to our understanding of the public records law, and the accretion of 30 years of public records litigation doesn't help us by definition, because of the court's opinion, in understanding SAFE's situation. The holding in the court's opinion is that the exceptions that SAFE invokes do not apply, that is to say, the exceptions that SAFE invoked under the public records manual, public records law, do not apply to requests filed pursuant to the specialized SAFE public records statute. And for that reason, these are two separate categories of law now. They don't help us. They tell us that the exemptions don't apply, but they don't tell us about, except for the particular dispute here, about how to apply the existing specialized SAFE statute. And they tell us definitively that we can't use our learning from what has accrued over the last 30 years or so to help understand which of SAFE's records are disclosable and are required to be disclosed and which are not.
I want to give voice to our silent members this afternoon. Both Senator Starr and Senator Verger have questions. Senator Starr is first.
No, I'm gonna pass, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Verger.
Yes, I have a question. Just by definition, did the court consider SAFE like any other state agency? Was the subject or the dispute, would it have been the same had it been the Oregon Department of Transportation, Economic Development Department, all on the same, or was there a difference?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, there was a difference. And the difference is that an existing statute, the court held that an existing statute unique to SAFE was the determinant of whether the records in question had to be disclosed or not, and indeed specifically held that the public records exemptions that would apply to the Department of Justice or Department of Transportation, Department of Justice, any other department of state government were not available and were not useful in analyzing the question that the court faced in its case.
Thank you.
Excuse me, but I'm missing something now. You referred to that specific body of law that governs SAFE in this situation, their disclosure as versus public records law disclosure. If it's such a pain in the neck now, which it's proven to be, at least from SAFE's perspective, how did it ever come into existence? That's a dumb question, I suppose, but help me here.
Mr. Chair, I'm not prepared to give you a full, because I don't know the full legislative history of this. I do know, as I understand it, this statute had been in place for many, many years prior to the litigation arising. And I'm not aware that there ever had been another case in which that issue, I know that no other case had reached the appellate courts. And so I don't know whether over the years there had been any controversy that had been resolved short of an appellate opinion. I don't know whether in the institutional history of SAFE, whether Ms. Rockland or Mr. Davies is aware of any such matter, but I do know the statute had been in place as is for quite a number of years prior to the issue arising.
A question?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shepherd, did SAFE Corporation or the Attorney General appeal the appellate court ruling?
We sought review in the Oregon Supreme Court, and it was not, the court did not grant review. So the Court of Appeals opinion continued to be the law.
So the Court of Appeals opinion is the law of the land, basically, in the state of Oregon. So you could start another book, but it would be a little blue book, or a little black book, or whatever you want to call it, and that's Safe Corporation's little book. Is there any other state agency that would be impacted by the court's decision, such as OHSU or any other independent state agency?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, my own reading of the court's opinion is it's pretty unique to SAFE because certainly in its specific holdings, it's unique to SAFE because it does, as I say, turn on the analysis of these particular statutes. And as you say, we certainly can. Indeed, we have the first entry in that the new little black book of SAFE. It's important to recognize, though, a difference here, and that is that whereas a decision that involves the application of the public records law to Agency A, Department of Transportation, for example, affects the Department of Transportation, it also has utility in its application to addressing a similar request when a citizen asks for information from the Department of Justice or any other state agency that is within the public records manual. If we are developing a body of interpretive law that applies only to a single agency, we do not have the advantage of multiple sources of law feeding into the accumulation of knowledge about how to deal with that. They will continue to be unique to that set of statutes. Over time, you might accumulate 60 cases, as you have in the 30 years on the public records law or more. But during that time, there would be considerable amount of uncertainty, as I've said, about where those boundaries are.
Thank you for your sharing with us. I just keep having this image of getting out my needle and going to work and stitching some more stuff into this. And up to this point, Brenda, I'm not sure that you've made your case to change it all back to the more ideal world that you've discussed, and so I'm asking all my members to put their thinking caps on and help us to stitch this together, because I don't want to do it by myself. But, you know, we're going to return to this in the next couple weeks, again and again, and as we put these pieces together. So I Pete, I'd be open to listening to any thoughts you have. I'm sure the other members might as well. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to have, I guess, the having access to Mr. Shepard's experience to address a particular issue that was raised by Mr. Lyon's testimony, and it's been raised previously by Mr. DiLorenzo as it relates to the trade secrets issue, whereas other state agencies, you know, protect trade secrets because they're regulating private businesses that, you know, they don't want how they do business exposed to their competitors, whether that's DCBS or the Department of Transportation when it gets a bid in. And then the issue that we have here with SAFE protecting its own trade secrets. It's based on your experience in the issue, if you would address that particular point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I think I would agree with the point that was made to the extent that the most common context in which state agencies other than SAFE deal with trade secret questions and the exemption is in the situations like the ones you described, where the agency itself has not generated the trade secret, but in the course of doing its business has need of acquiring something that is characterized as a trade secret by someone who needs to submit it to the agency in order for the agency to perform its mission. I think it would be accurate to say that that's the most common area, probably by far. I don't know. I can't say, and Senator Starr, I have looked in, as I was sitting in the back of the hearing room and listening to the earlier testimony, I read through the public records, this section of our public records manual to see, and I can't answer the question of whether any state agency ever has itself asserted a trade secret exemption as to some of its own business practices and the like. So I can't tell you for sure that that hasn't occurred. It is conceivable. Nothing in the language of the trade secret exemption is necessarily limited to the circumstance that where it's most commonly used. Let me make one other observation for what it's worth on this question, and that is that it seems to me that this discussion is rather less a question of public records law than it is a basic policy choice about what kind of a mission you wish to have SAFE undertake. If you wish to have SAFE undertake a business mission that is very much like some functions that private industries perform, then perhaps the logic of having a trade secrets exemption be applicable to that state agency that nonetheless has in effect a business-like function is nonetheless, that might be something to consider. So again, what it's worth, that's be my answer to your question.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you. I would submit that without the ability of that appellate court decision to go in and get access to all these records, we would have never been where we are today in terms of uncovering all of the corruption that we have seen come out of SAFE Corporation. And, you know, to Ms. Rockland's credit, she's been over there cleaning it up. But there's a lot there that we would never have seen. This issue would have sat below the radar screen, and we would have never gotten the information we needed, and Oregonians would have never known what was going on under the Catherine Keene dynasty. And in fact, we don't even know what was going on because Ms. Keene has never been before our committee to talk about what went on under her watch. And while Ms. Rockman is over there now and everything looks great and we're doing well, when she leaves, who knows what it will become unless we continue to have transparency and the availability to get access to the records that we need and oversight of their budget and all these things that we're looking at here in the Legislative Assembly this year.
Pete, I'd like you to respond, recognizing that you essentially from the Attorney General's office argued SAFE's side of the argument. How do you feel about the fact that had you prevailed, we wouldn't know a lot of what we came to know because the court case didn't go your way? How do you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that I guess two things. One, because of we have an interesting institutional role the Attorney General's office have an interesting institutional role with respect to public records law. We perform two functions. We advise agencies about what the exemptions are and about the risks that they take or don't take when they assert or choose not to assert an exemption. But then we also have a sort of quasi-judicial role in which if under the public records manual a requestor is turned away by the agency, then the Attorney General's office has to make a call that is really independent of our advisory function. And in making that judgment, we have authority under law to order an agency to disclose records. Because of the way, so I think that from an institutional standpoint, as the agency charged with the quasi-judicial function, I'm very much aware, and we are very much aware, of the presumption of the public records law that the statute begins with the proposition that public records are disclosable unless there is an exemption that specifically applies. And so when we advise agencies about what they can do, and then when we issue our orders, we strive always to suggest to them that they need to view the exemptions in that context. So my bias is, if you will, is in favor of the transparency question. So that in partial answer to your question, I don't feel good about the proposition that maybe those materials wouldn't have been disclosed. But let me address a second piece of this, and I think this is a very important one. Again, it goes back to something I said at the front end. The exemptions, for very large part, and specifically including the trade secrets exemption, with some perhaps some limitations, these are exemptions that it ultimately is up to the judgment of the agency to exercise or not exercise. And the question assumes that the judgment would have been made if the court had determined that these exemptions did apply, that every person sitting in the chair over there at SAFE would have made that same judgment about not disclosing this information. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. And indeed, I've known Ms. Rockland for a considerable time, and I suspect, as Senator Walker has said, that a different judgment would have been arrived at under the same circumstances, under different leadership at SAFE. One could say, well, that is an uncertainty then, that we shouldn't depend on the good judgment and so forth of the leadership of SAFE, and yet that is the policy judgment the Assembly has made with respect to all other state agencies, other agencies as well. The Assembly relies upon agency heads to exercise good judgment in the application, not only the judgments about whether an exemption applies, but whether they will assert it, even if it does apply. So that's a very long-winded answer to what really is, I think, gently I would suggest, is a hypothetical question. Of course, we never reached that point because of the way the court decided.
Thank you. This is all very complicated stuff. I'm going to ask you all to step back because I want to close the hearing and give, let's be fair here, a lot of people who signed up on the other two bills a chance to get their thoughts on the record today. I don't like to haul people back too often, especially if they've done some traveling. Senate Bill 984. I'm going to close the hearing on 507, right?
Correct.
And
yeah.
Open the hearing on 984 for a minute. Very quickly, Judith, would you tell us what this is about?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 984 requires SAFE Corporation to make workers' compensation insurance available to all Oregon employers except those determined not to be qualified for coverage. It does specify what attributes that would be to make them unqualified for coverage. It prohibits the director of DCBS and SAFE Corporation from treating an employer as not qualified on the basis of the employer's occupational classification, and it establishes a presumption that certain rate filings are unfairly discriminatory. We declare an emergency effective on passage. We have a no revenue impact on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't know who wants to go first on 984. Brian and Chris may be sick and tired of being up here first. On the other hand, Brian Bowe might like a chance to go first for a change. So I think I'll invite him up to have a...
I'll reluctantly accept your...
Yeah, I'm sure you're very reluctant. Why don't you hold forth for a few minutes? You know that Brenda and Chris will follow you, and we'll have some dynamic back and forth here. Again, I have my own questions that I have written out and thought about and have in front of me, but I want to see what you got to say for yourself and see where we go.
Happy to do it, Mr. Chair. Thank you. For the record, my name is Brian Bowe, and I'm appearing here this afternoon representing Liberty Northwest Insurance Corporation, where I serve as Vice President of Public Affairs. I would like to begin by thanking the committee for taking the time to delve into a complex and difficult issue. Workers' compensation insurance, as a policy issue, can be deceptively simple in many respects and frustratingly complex in others. In many ways, it is unique unto itself and, unfortunately, not particularly particularly interesting as a topic of general inquiry.
No kidding.
So I commend the committee members for their willingness to tackle the issue and find out why it has been near and dear to our hearts at Liberty Northwest and why we believe there are concerns of broad public interest in Oregon's current workers' compensation insurance market that warrant close examination and ultimately reform. In the last election cycle, Liberty Northwest sponsored and supported ballot measure 38 that would have allowed the state to privatize or mutualize the state accident insurance fund. And while over 700,000 Oregonians agreed that the state should remove itself from the insurance business, we failed to convince a majority of Oregon voters that the option contained in measure 38 was the right solution for the problems at SAFE. We accept the outcome and have adjusted our plans accordingly. However, the problems that spurred the debate around whether or not the state of Oregon should continue to operate a workers' comp insurance company reflect much broader public policy issues than simply the competitive jockeying of two insurance companies. That is the simple explanation, and as a result, that is how the story has been reported by the press and others involved in the debate. To start to explain why we support Senate Bills 984 and 986, let me begin by correcting some commonly held misperceptions about the Safe Liberty battle. Liberty Northwest and its parent company, Liberty Mutual Group, have never in our collective histories advocated unilateral opposition to state-sponsored workers' compensation insurance funds. But over the past 10 to 15 years, we have become increasingly concerned about the market conduct of what we call aggressive state funds and the loss of a defined and proscribed public purpose and mission exhibited by those entities. Before I detail how those concerns apply specifically to the legislation you are considering here today and SAFE's role in Oregon's workers' comp market, let me first provide the committee with some very brief history on how our state evolved in this respect. In 1913, Oregon decided, as a number of other states did at that time, to create a state monopoly that was the sole source of workers' comp insurance. What came to be known as the State Industrial Accident Commission, or SIAC, was a complete monopoly until 1965. In 1965, Oregon adopted the three-way system that allowed employers to either insure with a state fund, a private carrier, or self-insure. Breaking the SIAC monopoly was a big deal. Employers headquartered outside of Oregon could now cover their Oregon operations through a single policy purchased in their home state rather than being required to buy a separate policy from SIAC. Larger Oregon employers could now utilize self-insurance as a cost-effective option for meeting their workers' comp insurance needs, and all Oregon employers had a greater choice of who would insure them. As all states began to adopt workers' compensation insurance requirements, they faced a dilemma. Some employers were unable to secure the required insurance. Workers' compensation insurance is unique in that the universe of employers who purchase it can be neatly divided into two segments. The segments are referred to as voluntary and involuntary. Voluntary accounts are those that have a reasonable accident history and, due to their size and other factors, can be insured on a profitable basis. Involuntary are those accounts that, for reasons of poor accident history, high-risk vocations, size, and other factors, are assumed to be risks that cannot be insured profitably at standard rates. As a result, states gradually adopted programs to provide insurance for this involuntary market, either through an assigned risk plan, which allocated poor risks among insurers within the state, or by actually getting into the insurance business themselves and writing policies for employers. So, from a policy perspective, there was a need. Certain employers were unable to get the necessary insurance, and there was a public purpose to ensure coverage was available under a mandatory system. The stage was set, and some states jumped into the business. Today, about half the states have some sort of state fund, while the remainder rely on private competitive markets. In Oregon, after the change in 1965, SIAC became SAFE and maintained its public purpose by functioning as the insurer of last resort, providing coverage for the involuntary market. This three-way system has continued without change as the structural framework for Oregon's workers' comp system. There have been tremendous changes, however, in SAFE's public purpose, its role in the market, and as a result, the nature, character, and conduct of the state insurer. It is those changes and the issues associated with those changes that will most accurately explain why you have Senate Bill 984 and 986 in front of you today. Senate Bill 984 seeks to address concerns arising out of the changes in how SAFE fulfills its public purpose relative to the involuntary market. SAFE enjoys an exemption from federal income tax. Obviously, this is a tremendous advantage for any business. Federal statute is quite clear about the source and logic of this exemption. It is derived from the state insurance fund's role as a sure market, offering insurance to all employers within a state. Given the fact that Oregon's assigned risk pool currently contains over 12,000 Oregon employers that have been refused coverage by SAFE, it is not unreasonable to question whether or not the IRS would find SAFE in compliance with that statute. While SAFE has solicited credible legal advice that they are not likely to be found liable for federal income tax, there are equally credible legal opinions that conclude the opposite. One prudent response would be to seek a resolution directly with the Internal Revenue Service and end any speculation that SAFE may be carrying a large and dangerous liability. Other state funds have done this and curtailed any speculation or uncertainty regarding their federal tax status. But we believe Senate Bill 984 contains a better policy solution to SAFE's uncertain tax status than simply checking to see if the IRS will look the other way. Senate Bill 984 will return SAFE's public purpose by requiring it to make the essential benefit it offers, subsidized insurance, available to all Oregon employers subject to the reasonable exemptions spelled out in the bill. Why do private insurers care? Private insurers care because SAFE was originally created with a very specific public purpose in mind, to provide insurance to employers who otherwise could not obtain it in the private market. To accomplish this special purpose, it was created with special advantages, including an exemption from federal income taxes. If SAFE is going to abandon or significantly diminish its role in carrying out this mission, then there should be a thoughtful discussion within the legislature about how that mission should change, who should stand to benefit, the policy reasons for making such a change, and so forth. Until now, that simply hasn't happened. Let me illustrate exactly what I'm referring to here. Please look at the charts I have provided with my testimony. As you can see from the chart that's entitled Oregon Assigned Risk Pool, Number of Employers, this chart, it details the population of Oregon Assigned Risk Plan. You can see that in 1990, there was a very dramatic and significant increase in the number of companies who were forced to obtain coverage from the pool. That resulted from a massive cancellation of 10,000 of SAFE's smallest policyholders. At the same time, SAFE management cited the agency's poor financial performance as the justification for this action. Subsequent audits called into question the actual extent of SAFE's alleged financial predicament at that time, but when the 10,000 businesses were canceled, SAFE was posting some large losses. The commotion and uproar that accompanied these cancellations was one of the key factors that led to the Mahonia Hall reform. As the chart illustrates, the changes in SAFE's underwriting practice that accompanied the cancellations in 1990 have remained in place. I'll depart from my written remarks here. As you can see, Mr. Chair, prior to 1990, Oregon's assigned risk pool had rather nominal populations. Then in 1990, when the 10,000 businesses were canceled, it appears that almost the entire lot of those cancellations were moved into the assigned risk pool. And while the pool population has fluctuated up further and down, it has never returned to its pre-1990 levels. Those changes represented a major shift in SAFE's mission. Prior to the cancellations of 1990, SAFE essentially offered insurance to any Oregon employer who requested it, in keeping with the traditional view of state funds. Absent a horrific accident history, and if you paid your premium on time, SAFE would cover your business if you asked them to. After the events of 1990, SAFE adopted a much different and much more selective criteria for insurance coverage. In fact, they began to operate very much like any other private insurer. Again, let's step back and look at what we have here. SAFE was created with special financial advantages like income tax exemptions to provide a subsidized insurance product to serve a specific segment of Oregon employers with a specific need. Upon the decision of SAFE management in 1990, and without the benefit of legislative oversight or input, SAFE stopped performing that function and began a very different use of their special advantages in the Oregon market. At this point, you may be wondering, if they are no longer subsidizing the insurance for those businesses that are now in the assigned risk plan, who's getting the subsidy now? It's a very good and very legitimate policy question. There is a simple and direct answer. The policy implications, however, are more far-reaching and troubling. The advantages and special considerations that were granted to SAFE to facilitate coverage of the involuntary market have been applied to the voluntary market. Those businesses, the vast majority of which are fully capable of going into the private insurance market and obtaining competitive quotes for their workers' comp insurance, have a good chance at getting subsidized insurance from the state, while those that may have some of the qualities originally targeted for subsidized insurance are relegated to the assigned risk pool. Now, I know that there are some at this point who would clap their hands and say, hurrah for cheap insurance for those businesses that can get it. But let's put our policy caps back on and take a closer look at exactly what we're doing. We have taken the smallest of the small, the entrepreneurs, the startups, those that need help with workplace safety issues, and said, you must pay the highest rates, and then taken the money originally intended to assure they had coverage and given it to companies who have no demonstrable need of a state subsidy. Many have justified the current market conduct of SAFE, described here, by citing an implicit mandate to provide competitive pressure in the Oregon market. It is important to realize that supporters of the current system do not use the word competition in its normal sense, meaning that prices are set by the interaction of private citizens in the marketplace. Instead, they use the word to mean prices determined by a government agency and imposed on the market. The system is not, as has often been alluded to, market-driven. Let me be candid regarding this point. SAFE's inherent financial power, due to 80 years of accumulated reserves and tax-free investment income from those reserves, a tax exemption on revenues from new and ongoing business, is so pervasive that without a defined public mission to channel its use and application, competitive pressure is actually code for state-sponsored domination. Oregon's workers' comp market share statistics bear this out. And I've also included in your packets, Mr. Chair, a chart entitled Top 30 Insurers in the Oregon Market. And it shows the distribution of market share. And I would add a few words of explanation when you examine market share in Oregon, because one of the common points to emerge when this subject is discussed is that, now, hey, wait a minute, private insurers have 50-some-odd percent or 49%, I forget the exact current figure, of market share in Oregon. What's important to remember is that private market share in Oregon are accounts, the vast majority of which are not actually written in Oregon. In the industry, they're referred to as accommodation accounts, and let me explain that. Say a company is headquartered in Georgia and has a distribution facility in Oregon. That company purchases its workers' comp insurance in Georgia and covers its Oregon facility under that policy. But that coverage shows as a portion of the private insurer market share in Oregon. But in actual practice, that insurance is not purchased in Oregon. It's not available. I, as Liberty, as an insurance company, if we knocked on their door and said, hey, we'd like to sell you some insurance, they'd say, sorry, the home office in Georgia buys that. So it's important to remember as you look at market shares, because they'll point at this and say, well, you know, private insurers are doing fine. And that would explain what you see in this kind of distribution here, where SAFE has the lion's share, there's Liberty Northwest, and then all others, all this little stubble on the other side of the chart here, are all these different insurers who write accommodation business here for accounts located elsewhere. The reason that Senate Bill 984 is so vitally important is that it addresses the gaps in Oregon statutes that have allowed this situation to occur outside of and without the knowledge or direction of the legislature. Under SAFE's current mission statement, there is virtually unlimited flexibility for whomever is manning the helm at that agency to sell insurance under whatever circumstances that person deems expedient. And that, and this is an issue that we've discussed before in the committee, and that I hope the committee will dig into. When you really look at SAFE's mission statements and how it confines or actually guides their market conduct and their practices in the Oregon market. Senate Bill 984 will provide a framework to return SAFE to a defined public purpose and give the legislature the information and control it needs over the operations of this state-owned insurance company. I will not take the time right now to walk through the specific sections of the bill and the details, as I believe Mr. DiLorenzo's presentation on behalf of Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy will cover that at the later date. I have comments on 986, Mr. Chair.
And we may get to those today, but I want to stop with 984 right now. And unless there's questions, Senator Starr.
Thank you, Brian, for your testimony. Mm-hmm. Question that I have is, you know, we changed the statute, we passed the bill, we tell SAFE to insure everybody, regardless of their risk. Don't we go back to a situation where SAFE is in a situation that they're losing money and at some point they're not a solvent insurer? Isn't that the risk that we get into if mm-hmm. We go back to that route?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I don't believe so. My background is, you know my background. I'm not an actuarial expert, and so I can't really go into the details or be very eloquent in that regard in answering your question. But I could direct you to another chart that I attached to my testimony. And that is how the state funds, the different states deal with this particular issue. As you see from the pie chart, 28 states have no state fund, and of the five function as a total monopoly, and of the 18 that have a state fund, only four utilize an assigned risk pool with a state fund. In all other instances, 14 states act as this bill would require SAFE to act, and they do so and maintain their solvency quite easily. I'm not aware of any of these 14 state funds that have been facing solvency or insolvency issues in recent history.
Thank you.
Good question.
Brian, would you step back? Mm-hmm. I realize that I'm running things maybe in a strange way, but I want to ask John Schultz to come up to answer a question for me. From his perspective. And Brenda, why don't you come up at the same time?
Mr. Chair, while they're doing that, I would like to let you and the committee know that I have a bill, but unfortunately it's not in this committee, it's in Commerce, Senate Bill 751, which requires the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to conduct a biennial review of placement of subject worker of employers in the assigned risk plan. Mr. Schultz and I went over that in detail, and he did give us some testimony about that assigned risk plan, I believe, in December before we came into session. So if we don't pass this bill, we do also have other options to look at why people are stuck in the assigned risk plan.
Yeah. I'm still thinking about my quilt, so there may be pieces of this bill that end up, you know, stitched into the whole thing. John, I want to ask you a question, and that simply, most simply, would be to respond to Senator Starr's question of Brian Bowe just now. What would happen? I mean, the assigned risk pool, and you remember way back in the interim, Senator Morris raised this question as he was a member of the interim committee. He couldn't understand, and he's a very highly respected businessman, why the assigned risk pool was so huge in Oregon. He raised issues of public purposes. You know, the public purpose of SAFE as it relates to tax-exempt status and so on. Do you remember all of that conversation with Senator Morris? At least we had that conversation up here at the desk. I don't know if you do or not.
Mr. Chair, I think I recall most of that, yes.
Well, with regard to that and with regard to Senator Starr's question, would you hold forth for a moment?
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, I'll do my best. I did hand out some testimony regarding Senate Bill 984, and attached to that, as Senator Walker mentioned before, we did provide a report last summer to the Interim Committee on General Government regarding the Oregon Assigned Risk Program, and that report is attached to that testimony, and I would highly recommend your review of that report. The assigned risk program here in Oregon has been established so that there is a residual market, or a market for employers who are unable to obtain voluntary coverage either through SAFE or private insurers here in Oregon. And I think that the question is that if a good portion of that market went to SAFE Corporation, and in my reading of SB 984, it doesn't move the entire assigned risk market to SAFE. In other words, it doesn't make SAFE the insurer of last resort, but it moves a great deal of that market to SAFE Corporation. What would happen? A couple of things that that I would bring up about that is that there can be some unintended consequences that I would want the committee to be aware of. One of the things that excuse me, I'm just getting over a cold, so I've got a little bit of a frog in my throat. One of the things that I'm not sure that too many people are aware of is that there are discounts in the assigned risk pool that are extended to the employers that need to get their coverage through the pool, and especially in two regards. One is for non-experienced rated premium, or in other words, those employers who don't qualify for an experience rating. They qualify for an 11% credit of premium up to $500, and that's available to an employer who doesn't meet the eligibility requirements by having an experience rating. That credit was introduced in 1990 and has been periodically tested by our actuaries, and we consider it to be a very valid credit. The second credit is a new small employer credit. This credit is up to 15% of the premium, and it's available for the first 2 years of coverage, provided the employer has never been a subject employer and has not inherited an experience from a former owner of a business. In other words, that an owner of a business just tries to change the name of the employer so that they can get new coverage. This really is a new small employer. This is for new small employers that have premium greater than the class minimum but less than $2,500 after the application of the non-experience rated premium credit. What I'm getting at here is there's credits available for these types of employers. Those credits aren't available in the voluntary market. If I'm not mistaken, and my colleagues here to my right can correct me if I'm wrong, the minimum premium in the voluntary market, I believe, is $500 for an employer to get workers' compensation coverage in the voluntary market. With the credits that are available for non-experience rated employers and new small employers, they often can get coverage for less in the assigned risk pool than what they would pay what they would have to pay for coverage in the voluntary market.
And John, just for the record, who pays for those credits?
Mr. Chair, that's a very good question, and that goes...
Make it clear and concise, please.
Okay. That goes to the issue of who is subsidizing
right. The
assigned risk pool. And that the assigned risk pool today is subsidized by the workers' compensation market at large.
That means all these guys.
all of the employers in Oregon are essentially subsidizing the assigned risk market. And the policy issue there is, can we provide workers' compensation coverage for employers who can't get it for whatever reason at a price that is affordable so that they can stay in business, versus balancing that with the policy of wanting employers to pay their fair share?
Okay. Did you see the pie chart that Brian was sharing with us? What are those 14 states out of 18 states doing? Apparently we have moved this load out all over everybody, so that people that are in the private arena end up kind of subsidizing people in the public arena. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
It's kind of a double whammy on them, it seems to me.
Well, what we've got there is you've got an insurer of last resort model in those states, if I'm understanding that right. The 14 states, it's where the state fund is acting as the insurer of last resort.
Right. But these credits are available for the new guys that are starting up, right? Is that what you said?
Not necessarily in those 14 states.
I'm talking about here in Oregon.
I'm talking about here in Oregon, yes.
All right. If they're available for new guys that are starting up, would it be cheaper in the long run to go the way the 14 states have gone? I'm assuming they don't have credits. I'm assuming that they do have more of an employer of last resort model, which hasn't led them into bankruptcy. They're still operating in those states. Maybe they're, and at least I heard just now, I don't know about this for sure, but their rates aren't all that much different or higher than ours. I guess, you know, if I can characterize this in a maybe a weird sort of way, but, you know, when you start out a new business and you get put in the assigned risk pool, it's almost like going to court and you're guilty till you're proven innocent rather than innocent until you're proven guilty. You follow my logic here?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I guess the points that I would make is that in Oregon, for those new and small employers with the discounts, they are probably getting lower rates in the assigned risk pool. The charges that they must pay for their premium in the assigned risk pool in Oregon are lower than what they would be paying in the voluntary market.
Does that have a depressing effect on the overall market? Because they are the ones that end up subsidized.
For those employers, no, we don't think so. Those employers are not the ones that are generating the losses. There are other types of employers that are in the assigned risk pool. The high risk employers are the high loss generating employers. But to answer your question, for those 14 state funds that are acting as the insurer of last resort, it's just a difference in who is subsidizing those employers. In those cases, the state fund employers are doing the subsidy. The subsidy in Oregon is spread to the market at large. For those state funds that are operating as the insurer of last resort, it's the policyholders of those state funds, if those employers are not paying their fair share in that assigned risk concept, then the policyholders of the state fund would be making up the difference. So that would be the main difference.
Senator Starr, he's probably tired of answering my questions. He'd be delighted to have one from you, I'm sure.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think in a roundabout kind of weird way, he answered the question.
Thank you.
That's a compliment, John.
But I'd like maybe a clearer answer. My question is, if this bill were to pass, And clearly it doesn't say employer or the insurer of last resort, but clearly it would transfer a significant amount of the assigned risk pool to Safe Corporation. Safe's ability to remain solvent, Safe's ability to remain in the insurance business, to be a carrier that insures Oregon employers, based on your experience in the insurance world and your experience understanding the Oregon market, do we run the risk of a pre-1990s situation where Safe as a state agency is carrying a huge liability and it's not possible to transfer that liability to its other insureds, and it comes knocking on the state's front door and says, hey, we're the state insurer, we're a state asset, and we got a big problem, state legislature, come and divvy up some funds so we can remain solvent and pay out claims and do everything that we need to do as an insurance company. Is that not a risk? Is that not a problem? Is that not something that we ought to be concerned about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, yes. Generally, you would be taking more of a risk in that area. Safe would be taking on more risk and would have less opportunity to mitigate that risk under this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I need to respond to that.
Go ahead.
Okay, let's get down to the real reason we have low workers' compensation rates in this state. And if you answer differently than I expect you to, I'll be surprised. Because just last week, it was announced that Oregon had lowered its workers' comp rates again, that we had some of the lowest rates in the nation again. The number one reason for low rates in this state and any other state, and it was repeated by the Department of Business and Consumer Services last week, is not the existence of Safe Corporation and their ability to fund people in group plans or through the ARP. It is because we prevent accidents. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes. That's
right.
Probably the most dominant factor, I shouldn't say probably, the most dominant factor for several years now has been the declining rate of injuries.
Exactly, Mr. Chair. And so when we talk about if SAFE goes back to insuring these high-risk employers, that's not why we had the problem in the 1990s. The problem in the 1990s was because we weren't preventing accidents in the first instance, and the whole reform, the Mahonia Hall reform, it had some good things and it had a lot of bad things. But the good things were that we implemented all these workplace safety programs. Isn't that correct, Mr. Schultz?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's correct. But I would also add there was, in addition to the workplace safety initiatives, there were several other initiatives as well, such as return to work,
correct,
managed care organizations, changes in the compensability standards. There were lots of factors that came together to drive a very successful lowering of the cost of workers' compensation here in Oregon.
And that's correct. And I don't have those files with me, and I could point them, just nail them right down the line. But the point I'm making is that Safe Corporation is not the reason we have low rates. So by taking people out of the assigned risk pool and making Safe be the insurer of last resort, which is what this state asked it to be until it got carried away and decided it was going to be a business, that's not going to impact Safe in a negative way, in my opinion. Now, everybody else can have a different opinion. That's what this process is all about. But, clearly all the research I've done on the web, and I've done documents piled high, as you know, it all came down to the simple fact preventing injuries is the best way to keep your workers' comp rates low. And the assigned risk pool is one place that we put people, and we also give people, Mr. Chair, that's another bill we're going to discuss, is we give people these good rates if they're part of a group plan. So if you're not part of a group plan and you're a new business that doesn't have a track record, you're going to go into the assigned risk pool. But as Mr. Schultz points out, there are some credits available to you, but those are shared and paid for by everyone else in the market. Correct? All right.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's correct.
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Chair,
you feel better now, huh?
I feel better now. I have two pieces of chocolate.
Mr. Chair, if I could just make one more comment you in terms of the testimony that I provided. I know you're very busy, and you probably get tons more reading than you're able to keep up with. I would just recommend, in terms of the report on the assigned risk pool, that you look at pages 10 and 11, which really does go into the issue of SAFE as the insurer of last resort, and I think it would give you some perspective on this issue that I think you would find helpful in making these policy decisions.
Well, thank you for sharing. Brenda, do you want to respond to Senator Walker's comments of the last few minutes? I mean, I see a real difference between somebody that has a high loss record being in that assigned risk pool and somebody who is guilty of the crime of being an entrepreneur, guilty of the crime of being new without a history, and therefore ending up in the same mud puddle, you know? I don't quite understand why they're there. I keep harking back to Senator Morris and his contributions to this committee during the interim. Can you please?
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'm going to refer that question to Chris Davey, who has some written testimony before you, and I think can address that specific question.
Okay. Go ahead, Chris. I need to say to everybody that's here, I know we had four bills, and we've only gotten, well, five, and we've only gotten through four. If you want to testify on the other bill, the 986, you'll have to suffer as much as I have. I mean, this is boring stuff. It's going to be long, and it's hard, and I don't see anybody that's traveled 100 miles to be here. Do you? Is there anybody that's traveled 100 miles to be here? Is there anybody outside of... I think everybody that suffered through this is a paid lobbyist or a member of so we're going to come back because I can only tolerate this stuff so long. Okay, Chris, with that, continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, do I
feel bad when I tell you I find this fascinating?
I have a therapist that you can talk to.
We find it fascinating, too, Senator Walker.
I'm glad.
I'm Chris Davey for SAFE Corporation, and I think what I'll do is just quickly go through my testimony because we're going to have to come back and talk about this some more. We saw this bill for the first time last week. We found out about the hearing 2 days ago, like everybody else, and although we started doing some research...
You found out about it last week?
The bill was introduced last week, Mr. Chair.
Yes, that's right.
And we started doing some research on this, and obviously we haven't had time to complete that yet. But I guess the things I'd like to say today deal with, first of all, this issue of this connection with the tax exemption. And this is like one of those issues that won't die. This has been around for a while. It's been discussed in the press. Legal opinions have been out there and made available to a lot of people. And let me just quickly tell you what this is about. That in the mid-1990s, the United States Congress passed a bill that dealt specifically with the federal tax liability of state workers' compensation funds. And it listed various, I think there are five elements that a state fund needs to meet, or combinations of those elements, in order to be exempt from taxes. Up to that point, SAFE, of course, had been exempt from taxes from federal taxes because it is an instrumentality of the state, and the federal government does not tax the states. So the creation of SAFE did not, in itself, by the legislature, give SAFE a federal tax exemption. The fact that it was an entity of the state brought with it a federal tax exemption. So when the Congress dealt with this issue with a little more specificity in the mid-90s, we hired a law firm in Washington, D.C., worked with the Department of Justice to do this, who specialize in these tax issues. They researched this thoroughly. They had done a lot of work in other states on the same issue, and they came back with an opinion that said that SAFE is not liable for federal taxation, not only under the new law, but under any other law that might apply. The Department of Justice reviewed that. The attorneys in Washington, D.C. were given special attorney general status or whatever that special name is, so that their opinion, in effect, had the effect of being an opinion of the
Department
of Justice.
And when was this again?
I beg your pardon?
When was this again?
This opinion was in the late 90s, and actually the opinion is attached to our report that this committee has seen, and we can point that out to you. The issue came up again last year. It was reported in the press. Senator Kate Brown asked Legislative Council the same question that had been asked before, and she received the same response, that according to their review of all the evidence, SAFE was not subject to federal taxation. And we have seen no other opinions. Now, Mr. Bowe testified. He said, I believe that there were equally credible opinions that said that SAFE is liable for taxation. We haven't seen them. And if they exist, I think it's incumbent upon him to make them available for other people to see them. We, in fact, did waive the attorney-client privilege in order to make our opinion available for the legislature and anybody else to see. So the premise for this bill seems to be that we'll pass this bill and it will somehow save from this prospect of federal tax liability. And we believe that premise itself is faulty. But having said that, taking a look at the assigned risk pool and how companies get into the pool and how various insurance companies deal with the pool is a very important subject and one that we think is worthy of consideration. Now, one of the things that has already come up in testimony and has been repeated several times is this myth that if a company is new and they apply to SAFE Corporation, they will not be insured and have to go to the assigned risk pool. And there may indeed be some instances where a combination of factors might lead a new business to be declined coverage by SAFE. But the simple fact that a business is new and applies to SAFE for a voluntary insurance coverage is not going to be a factor that would cause that business to be denied coverage and send them to the assigned risk pool.
Now, okay, so you're saying that's a myth, and I've been fed an untruth. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, I called it a myth.
Okay. What percentage do end up in the assigned risk pool versus the number of businesses that are new that end up with SAFE or with a private company or whatever? What's the percentage?
Mr. Chair, if you're asking what percentage of new businesses who apply to coverage for SAFE are turned down, I can't tell you that today, and that's probably part of the information that we'll be able to put together as we look into this further. But one thing that I thought
don't
would be...
Don't you think that's a key piece of information?
Yes, I do.
I guess the fact that you've already known this was going to be up for a hearing for a couple of days is the reason you don't have that answer?
Yes, that's...
Okay, let me say to everybody, the next hearing on this issue is the 17th of March. Okay?
2 weeks from today.
I want everybody to have answers to everything that they might conceive of when we come back together. Okay?
And we'll be happy to do that, Mr. Chair. Just so that you understand how the...
In fact, I'd like to get some of that information between hearings.
As soon as it's available.
You know, we're working under some timelines here.
The businesses...
Okay. Senator Verger has a question.
Mr. Chair, I want to go back a little bit to, as a part of this conversation, what Senator Walker said, which is very, very true, that we have become far more adept at taking care of people and preventing accidents. And I point to the mill, Georgia Pacific Mill in Coos Bay, that has had the OSHA award that is actually put forth and instigated by the employees themselves. But having said that, and since businesses work so hard to prevent these, then you come along and say, well, you're going to put everybody into this high risk and let everybody else pay for it. Well, as a SAFE business, I'm not too interested in doing that. I'm interested in preventing my people from having an accident. And if people want to be disregard that and not try to keep people from having an accident, and then to be a burden and expect other people to pay, is to me illogical. So I just want to, before we get too far along that track, I want to throw that out. It would be just like all of us having to subsidize people that don't take care of themselves and end up having something that they could have prevented. Now, I'm not saying if that disease and those kinds of things, but I'm talking about things that can be prevented, and expecting other businesses that work very hard to come up and pony up the money to pay for that is just not fair.
Mr. Chair, may I make a comment on that?
Yes, I allow you to make a response to that.
Just very quickly, Senator Walker indicated that she has a bill to have a study done every 2 years to take a look at the assigned risk pool, and we think that is a good idea, and it should deal with those sorts of policy issues to help the legislature decide on the policy around the assigned risk pool and deal with exactly those sorts of questions. Should it be subsidized? If so, who should subsidize it and how much?
Thank you for that plug, Mr. Schultz.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair, if I could then move on to talking about the very quick study that we were able to do in the last couple of days.
I'm going to call this hearing to a close in the next 5 minutes. Okay?
I'll probably take 2 minutes.
All right, do it in
okay.
2 minutes.
The assigned risk pool is divided evenly between SAFE and Liberty for servicing purposes. We have approximately 5,500 accounts. Yesterday, we took a random sample of those and were able to look at 77 accounts, 1.4% of those that we service, to try to figure out why they are in the assigned risk pool. And on page 2 of the testimony at the top, you'll see why they're there. 29% of those accounts are there because they have had credit problems that indicate that in the future they may be less likely to pay their bills. 17% never even applied to SAFE in the first place. There is no requirement that anybody going into the assigned risk pool has to be rejected by SAFE. 17% never even tried. 16%, for reasons that John Schultz already spoke about, find it cheaper to be in the assigned risk pool than to be with SAFE. And the next biggest category was 13% who are there because their losses are excessive and the assigned risk pool rates are more appropriate for the loss experience that they've had. So that's 75% of the very small study that we did just yesterday. And as you can see, most of those reasons are for choices made by the employer or actions taken by the employer that have jeopardized their insurability, rather than SAFE having determined that we didn't want them anymore and they needed to go to the assigned risk pool. If I could just quickly pick out a couple of points from the other observations that we've made here. Our assigned risk pool is smaller than the national average. It's increased recently because of the underwriting cycle that has seen a number of insurance companies go bankrupt and others restrict their writings, and so private insurance companies have moved business into the assigned risk pool. We insure many more small businesses than private insurance companies, and according to a DCBS report that you received last year, SAFE insures 27,000 small Oregon employers, whereas Liberty only insures 1,200. So that seems to speak to the fact that SAFE does reach out to small business. And I think I will just leave it at that for now.
Chair, can I
yes.
have one question?
Yeah.
He skipped the bullet point that I think... at least in my mind, is pretty important, and that's the one that Senate Bill 984 would impose a standard that may not comport with, quote, sound insurance principles. Can you just touch briefly on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr. That's a reference back to SAFE's statutory mission, which says, with a bunch of lead-in, that SAFE must perform according to sound insurance principles, and the concept of taking... in fact, what would if this bill were implemented and if it were based on the experience rating modification threshold, 98% of the business in the pool would become a SAFE account. And it would not be a sound insurance principle for us to take that many cases that clearly have
for loss experience.
And Mr. Chair, would that not have some impact on the safe's ability to remain solvent, be an insurance carrier that could remain in business? And ultimately, again, I go back to the situation where it further put the state's general fund at risk at some level, potentially.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Staub. Obviously, if we have to take more bad risk business, then our losses are higher, and that means that we have to charge more money to all the accounts. Senator Verge is concerned that a good account will end up paying more money because SAFE is forced to take more bad risks.
And Mr. Chair, I know you want to close this off, but potentially if you're raising rates to other insurers, they potentially could go somewhere else, obviously depleting your ability to further spread out those risks. That scenario continue to the point where you have such a large pool of high-risk clients that you're in trouble.
Well, thank you, Senator Stowe. You have laid out the scenario that would follow, and it's kind of a domino theory, but that's where you would get, yes.
Thank you.
Of course, we're not all in the same place. Senator Verger has a question. I want to say to Brian that I'd like you to organize a response to this information this afternoon. I'm trying to get to the bottom line here. What works, what doesn't work. And I want some substance, and I'm not sure the case has been made yet by either side. Senator Verger.
Yes, I just wonder if you agree with me. Mine is more of a comment, but for your companies that are insured that go through all of these wonderful safety precautions, this includes spending their money on equipment, restructuring their building if necessary, lots of expense to that company. Aren't I right in that? Isn't that true? In order to not be a burden on the people that are insuring them, which is SAFE Corporation.
Well, yes, Senator Virchow, that's correct. As SAFE takes on more bad businesses, then the rates for the good businesses would go up.
They go up. But my point is that when you are trying to keep your workman's comp in line and not have a lot of paperwork coming to you because of injuries, those companies have also invested in extra equipment and all of these things that go into a part of that. So it's not only that they're paying for the insurance, they're paying even more on top of that.
Yes, that's correct, Senator.
And Senator, it goes beyond even just this choice between workers' compensation carriers and Oregon. Oregon enjoys a very low workers' compensation premium as compared to other states. We are in competition with other states for business. Workers' compensation, the cost of workers' compensation is one of the factors that determines whether or not a business stays in Oregon or comes to Oregon as well. And so that's a factor that we need to pay attention to as well.
I want to thank you all, and I want to thank the audience for their patience. I had intended to be done by 5 o'clock. I will tell the committee that the way we're setting things up, there's going to be more and more hearings that go late and long, and we've managed in the Senate to set ourselves up for long work days. I have a committee that's going to start meeting at 7 in the morning now, and
that's the beauty of Friday.
Then we've got this committee that at least one day a week, I think, will be going till 6 or 6:30. So we're just driving each other crazy.
We just love this stuff, Mr. Chair.
Oh, yeah, we love it today.
We're already in committee 6 hours a day, Mr. Chair.
I'm in four committees, so we're there. I'm going to adjourn. My apologies to you that didn't get to talk today. We're going to come back to all this, and I've already told you what day. Thank you.
Mrs. Rockland.
I want to answer you. Thank you.